Welcome to Salt Company, guys. If you got a Bible, pull it out. We're going to be in Luke 10:25. And so the last couple of weeks, we've been going through this new series on the parables. And we studied the parable, this short story of Jesus about a treasure in a field. We studied a story about a king who was having a banquet for his son who was getting married. And this week, we have another parable, and it's the parable probably that you've all have heard. Or at least if you've been in the church, you've definitely heard this one. This is the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? This is kind of one that we've heard. This is one that kind of is just in common culture. It's even this phrase now, being a good Samaritan. And this is the story where this comes from, is Luke 10:25. I'm just going to read this text for us to start off. It says, "And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' And he said to him, 'What is written in the law? How do you read it?' And he answered, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself.' And he said to him, 'You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live.' But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?' Jesus replies and he gives this story. And this is the story Jesus tells this man. Jesus replied, 'A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, when he came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him, and he bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal, and he brought him to an inn and cared for him. And took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii, that's like 2 days worth of wages, like hundreds of dollars. He takes out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him. And whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' And Jesus turns to this man, this lawyer, and he says, 'Which of these 3 do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?' And the lawyer said, 'The one who showed him mercy.' And Jesus said to him, 'You go and do likewise.'" Now, this is one of Jesus' most famous parables, right? A lot of us have heard this. We've heard this phrase before. And the point of the parable is obvious, right? The main point. It's that we're supposed to be people who do good to those who are in need. Now, that's true, and the parable absolutely means that for Christians, that we are to do good to people who are in need, but as we look at it closer, we realize that it is also saying much more than that. And so these are the 3 things I want us to see, that encountering Jesus, like this lawyer is encountering Jesus, it changes things about us. It changes the kind of questions we ask. It changes the kind of questions we ask. It changes the way that we see people, and it also changes the way we help people, or it changes the way we love people. So this is the first thing I want you guys to see, is that encountering Jesus changes the questions we ask. Now, this is the very first question that this lawyer asked, right? He says, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And this guy's a lawyer, okay? And don't think lawyer in today's world. This is like a lawyer back then. And so this guy is like a theologian. Like, he knows the Bible really well. He knows the Old Testament law super well. He has it down pat. And so it says that he didn't just ask Jesus because he genuinely was curious. It said that he stood up to put Jesus to the test. So maybe he's like testing Jesus, like, "I'm not sure about you, but I really know my stuff. And so I'm going to ask you a question to see if you know your stuff, Jesus." And so he asked Jesus, "Hey, what does one have to do to receive eternal life, to inherit the kingdom of God?" But Jesus, right, he never just answers a question straight away. He always flips it back on the person. And he says, "Well, what do you think? You know the law, like you're a lawyer, right? What do you think?" And so this guy responds, and he says, "Okay, this is what you have to do to inherit eternal life. You have to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your soul, all of your strength, all of your mind. And you have to love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus, kind of almost in like a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, he's like, yeah, that's right. That's it. Man, if you do that, you're going to live. And so some people read this and they're like, whoa, like we've been talking at Salt Company that you don't do things to get into the kingdom of heaven. And this lawyer is saying, this is what you do. And Jesus is like, yeah, if you do that, you'll get into the kingdom. And so wait a minute, I thought you didn't do something. I thought it was something Jesus did for you. But now look, think about this. Have there ever been a moment in your life where you have loved God with every single fiber in your being? All of your soul, 100%. Really? All of your mind, all of your strength, all of your, everything, 100%. And he's like, well, that's what you have to do, and you have to love your neighbor as yourself. Since we always do that all the time, right? We always treat everyone around us just like we want to be treated, right? And so he's saying, no, this is what you need to do. And Jesus is like, yep, if you do that, you'll go to heaven. Yep, if you do that all the time, you're going to be there. And it's kind of tongue-in-cheek because he's like, dude, you don't do that, right? Like, you don't do that at all. But this guy, it says that he's seeking to justify himself. And so he asks the second question. He goes, okay, but who is my neighbor? And here's what we have to know about this guy. This lawyer had an incredibly high view of himself. He had an incredibly high view of himself. When Jesus says, you're right, he doesn't even question the first part. He's like, okay, I definitely love God with everything inside me, definitely. But I just want to make sure this whole neighbor thing, I just want to kind of just make sure I got this down. He has an incredibly self-inflated view of himself. He is very self-righteous. And it says that he was seeking to justify himself with this question, and who is my neighbor? Which means that when he was asking this question, he wasn't asking it in like a, Jesus, who are the people that I'm supposed to love? Like, who can I love today? No, he's asking it in this sense. He's like, okay, I know that the law says I need to love my neighbor as myself, and so I really want to get clarity on who is in my neighborhood and who's not, right? Like, I want to know that. And basically what he's asking is, Jesus, who are the people I don't have to love? He's saying, Jesus, can you give me just the bare minimum, like the smallest amount that I have to love, because I want to make sure I check that box and go no further. He's asking Jesus for the bare minimum command in order to justify himself so he can just do that and nothing more, so he can say, I've attained this. I am righteous. I'm good. So this is the question. Who is my neighbor? And here's what you have to understand. For a Jewish person, this is an incredibly important question. Because to be a Jew, being a neighbor was a very weighty, weighty thing. There were tons of commands in the Old Testament that said, this is what you have to do for a neighbor, right? You have to love them like yourself. And it didn't just say that kind of in an abstract way. It gave very specific rules of how you had to treat your neighbors. And they were weighty. They were like your own family. You had to provide for them. If they were sick, you took care of them. If they had a need, you provided for them. And so it became very important to actually know who your neighbor was. And it became very important to know who your neighbor was not. And the Jewish people had very clearly defined lines. And their lines were not geographic, as though, okay, I live on the east side, and the east side, like, these are my boys. But the west side, like, we don't go over there, right? Like, that, we don't do that. That's not how it was. No, it wasn't geographic. It was ethnic. It was ethnic. And they were like, we're Jews. We're the people of God. We're of the tribe and nation of Israel. And this is our crew. And if you're not like us, you're not our neighbor. Doesn't matter where you live. Doesn't matter if you're next door to me. You're not like me. You're not Jewish. Their definition of neighbor were people that were exactly like them, believed what they believed, agreed with what they agreed. They had the same point of view as everyone they would consider their neighbor. So this is the question. You're saying, who do I actually need to take care of? Who do I actually need to care about? And this is an important question for them. It's an important question for us too, right? We live in a world where we're asking that question today, like all over social media. That question is being asked. Who is our neighbor? Right? As Americans that live in Iowa City, who are we obligated to take care of? Who are we morally responsible for? What about the 6.6 million Syrian refugees? One of the largest displacements of human beings in the history of the world. Are those people our neighbors? We live in a time where we have to ask this question. This is an important question for us. Are we only responsible for people who live on our side of the dorm floor? Or are we responsible for the people that we see on the internet that are over on the other side of the world? Who is our neighbor? It's an important question. Who are we morally responsible to take care of? But Jesus, in classic Jesus fashion, completely disregards this question. He completely disregards it. Did you guys kind of catch that as this happens? This guy asked, who is my neighbor? And then Jesus gives a story that doesn't answer that question at all. He gives a question, he like just is like, okay, you asked a terrible question. Let me answer this with a story that's not your question at all, right? He ends it and he's saying, so instead of saying, okay, here's who your neighbor is, he shows this person what it looks like to be a neighbor. He asks, who are the people I'm supposed to love? And he just answers a question. This is how to be someone who's loving. Jesus takes the limit away and says, no, let's just make this about you. This is how you be a neighbor. And so encountering Jesus, it changes the way we ask questions. It changes the kind of questions that we ask. And so Jesus, and as the guy asks this question, who is my neighbor? And Jesus responds with this story. Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Okay, Jerusalem, kind of this, the height of Jewish high life and society, like the most important place for Israel was Jerusalem. And then there was this other city, Jericho. And it's this 17-mile long road that kind of snakes from one end of this kind of almost country to the other. The country's really small and it's kind of in the middle to the other side. And it was a pretty long journey on foot. 17 miles, that's like a good hike. And it's windy, and it's in the middle of the desert. There's not a lot of water, and there's caves everywhere with bandits all over the place. And so everyone knew that if you go from Jerusalem to Jericho, you might get mugged, right? It's a dangerous place. It's a dangerous path. Everyone knows that, but you have to make this journey. And so a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers. Now, these robbers, what did they do? They stripped him, they beat him, and they departed. Really great guys, okay? Like, not only did they take his stuff, they took his clothes, okay? They were just like, here you go. You literally have nothing left. And it says that they left him half dead. Okay, so there's this guy, and he's on the side of the road. He's like in the ditch, right? They kind of dump his body after they beat him, and it says he's half dead. He's in a desert on this kind of windy road that not a lot of people go on, and he's going to die. That's how the story is supposed to end for this guy. He's going to die unless someone comes and saves him. He is screwed. But the story gives us hope, right? Jesus is telling it, and he goes, now by chance, just by chance, a priest was going down that road. And it's like, oh, that's what amazing luck. Like if you're this half-dead guy and you have like one eye open, you're like, oh, it's a man in robes. This is amazing. Like that's a best case scenario, right? Like a pastor's walking down the road. Like that's really, really good. And then this priest, he's walking along the road and it says that he sees him. He's not just like doesn't see him. No, he sees him. And when he sees him, he changes his course, walks to the other side of the road and passes him by. And this guy's dying, going to die, and the priest just walks by. And the next guy is a Levite. Now this is like basically like the guy who works at the temple. This is like a Salvation Army soup kitchen guy. Like this is a pretty good dude, you know? Like this is also like a home run. He's like, okay, that priest was horrible, but at least it's a Levite, right? I know these guys, they're great people. And then the Levite comes and he sees him. And he does the exact same thing. He changes his course, walks over here. He gets geographically further away from him and passes him. Do you guys ever do this? Like when you're driving and there's like a homeless guy asking for money, you're like, okay, I'm gonna get in the furthest lane from him. Do you ever do that? I've done that. Or you're like walking the Ped Mall and there's like, you know, one of the guys who's just always there and kind of always asking for money and you're like, all right, I was gonna walk down this way, but I'm gonna kind of go a little further this way so I can just kind of go on my way. think we do this kind of stuff. But look how the story continues. The next guy who comes isn't a priest. He's not a Levite. He's a Samaritan. And this guy's a dirtbag. That's who he is. He's a dirtbag. He is a lowlife. He is scum. He is like the worst person you could possibly think would come down the road. Like, this guy is a Jew and he's in the ditch. And he opens his eyes and it's like, are you kidding me? A Samaritan. This is like, there's no possible way this guy's going to help me. He's completely unlike me in every way. I hate him. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he saw the same person, but he had a totally different response. It says he had compassion for him. He had compassion for him. And this is the second point, is that encountering Jesus, it changes the way that we see people. It changes the way we see people. The Samaritan, right? Like, we're really distanced from this culture. Like, first century Samaria, like, we don't really understand how, like, that socioeconomic status worked. We don't really get that. But to be a Samaritan, and when Jesus says, hey, the next guy who came was a Samaritan, basically this is like an icon that represents someone that you despise and someone you look down on as less than you. A Samaritan is someone that you have devalued and dehumanized and considered worthless, because not only are they not like you, but you consider them as like a great example of what is wrong with this world. Samaritans, they're the worst. They come down from their cities and they rob our houses. They're these messed up people. They're completely unlike us. You know, in today's world, a Samaritan would be like, all right, here he comes down the road, a white supremacist. Thank you, God. He's here. Like, he's coming down the road, right? And you're like, this guy is horrible. Or it'd be like, you know, if you're on like the other side of the fence, he's like an abortion doctor. You're like, oh my gosh, like this guy, this person. And that's the way Jewish people thought about Samaritans. They hated them. They considered them unclean. In fact, they marginalized and despised them so much that they wouldn't even eat with them. It was like against the rules. Like, you don't eat with those people. You don't associate with people like that. They were even considered less than human. They go, man, people over here, these guys are bad, and these guys are really bad, but people from Shechem, Samaritans, they're not even human. People actually said that kind of thing back then. Maybe it's not that different from today. But Jesus takes one of these Samaritans, right, and he makes him the hero of the story. He's the hero. He's the one who shows mercy. Why? Why does Jesus do that? What Jesus is not doing is saying, man, you know Samaritans? Man, this is like an amazing culture, like this beacon of bright, shining light in a world that has no hope. Like, these people are incredible. Look how amazing Samaritans are. That's not what he's saying. No, Jesus picks a Samaritan to be the hero of the story because this man, this lawyer, couldn't stand them. He looked down on them, and he certainly did not consider them as anyone who would ever be worthy of his love or his care. In fact, he considered himself as objectively better than this Samaritan. Without question, this lawyer, when he heard Samaritan, he thought, oh. And the reason Jesus takes a Samaritan and he puts him as the main hero of this story is because he knows that the only way this lawyer can ever be a neighbor at all is if he learns how to give up his injustice, give up his prejudice, and give up his self-righteousness. He knows that if he doesn't learn how to take his prejudice and his self-righteousness and have that stripped away, he can never, ever be a neighbor to anyone. And what Jesus does is he takes his finger and he puts it on the real source of all the disunity, of all the divisiveness, of all the anger, of all the hatred that marks this world. And he says, this is where the problem is. And you know, the problem with the world is not that it's full of bigots and racists and xenophobes and abortion doctors or unqualified presidents. No, the problem with the world is that we all think we're better than those people. The very thing that we look at people and become angry at them for doing, by devaluing and dehumanizing entire subsets of the world. Like, you look at the white supremacist and you're like, are you kidding me? Because this guy's black, you think he's like less than you? Are you like, really? You think that? And what we do is we turn to that person, and even though we're angry because they devalue and dehumanize this group, we devalue and dehumanize them. And the cycle goes on and on. The problem with the world is that, like the man talking with Jesus, we are all incredibly self-righteous. We use whatever areas of righteousness that we have in order so that we can stand on them and point down and look down at all the people that aren't righteous in the ways we are. That's what we do. That's what self-righteous people do. They use their unique area of righteousness to look down on everyone around them. But the gospel changes the way we see people, right? And this Samaritan, he saw in a different way than the priest did, in a different way than the Levite did, and in a different way than this lawyer did. The gospel changes the way we see people because the gospel shows us that we are actually the ones in the ditch. And that's where Jesus found us. That's like the gospel story, is that Jesus found you when you were beaten, when you were stripped, completely exposed, left for dead, dying. And Jesus found you like that. And when Jesus saw you, he had compassion for you. He actually wasn't your neighbor. He wasn't anything like you. He was God. Yet he saw you and he had compassion on you. And he went to you and he bandaged your wounds and he healed you. And he actually paid with his life in order to fully make you whole once again. What made the Samaritan different than the other two people was that when he saw this man lying in the ditch, he didn't just think of excuses of why he wasn't like him or why he wasn't his neighbor or why he was too busy or why it was just too important for him to keep going down the road and maybe someone else is going to come up and help this guy, so I just need to keep going. No. He saw him and he had compassion on him. When he saw this man in the ditch, half dead, he saw himself. He didn't see him as different or below or distant. He identified with him. And this is what Jesus is trying to do for us, is because he's saying, man, the only way you're ever going to love your neighbor as yourself is when you start seeing your neighbor as yourself. You start seeing yourself in your neighbor. Instead of standing on your righteousness and looking down at those people and saying, I'm not like that. That's messed up. You stand next to whoever it is and you go, yeah, I'm actually just like you. Yeah, I'm that as well. And the Samaritan saw the man lying half dead, different than everyone else. He saw him differently. He saw the same person, but the thing he did different than everyone else is he actually had compassion, but more than that, he actually loved him. And this is the third thing. Encountering Jesus changes the way that we love people. Look what he did. He went to him. This is the Samaritan. He sees him. He has compassion, and he went to him. He didn't stay distant. He went right up close. He just got down in the filth, in the dirt, in the blood, in all of it, and he went to him, and he bound up his wound. Now, this is a guy who maybe he has an animal. He's got a horse, but he doesn't have like an entourage. It's just like a dude going down the road. And this guy has all these wounds. It says he bound his wound. And so what he's probably doing is like taking his cloak and like ripping it apart so that he can kind of bind this guy's wounds. And so he's like maybe tearing his clothing apart to cover this guy. He's pouring on oil and wine that he had planned to use for himself. Then he set him on his own animal and he brought him to an inn. And he stayed the entire night with him to take care of him. He didn't throw him some money and say, good luck, man. No, he spent time taking care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper saying, take care of him and whatever you spend, when I come back, I will repay you. Don't look at him and ask him to pay. I am going to pay for him. I've got this. And then, you know, Jesus asks this lawyer, he says, hey, which one of these 3 proved to be a neighbor? The lawyer says, hey, who is my neighbor? And he says, no, who proved to be a neighbor to this man who was hurt by the robbers? He says, the one who showed him mercy. And then Jesus said to him, you go and do likewise. The lawyer, he's asking for a limit to who and how much he has to love. He's saying, give me the minimum. Shoot me straight. What do I actually have to do? Give me a limit. Who do I have to love? How do I have to love them? And Jesus, he rejects the question and he tells him a story about a Samaritan who had limitless love. There was no limit. He says, here, you take care of him. Whatever it costs you, I will come back and pay it. There's a movie called The Count of Monte Cristo. Have you guys seen this? Yeah? Great movie. Classic, okay? Like one of the classics that you watch today and you still think it's good. Instead of like one of the ones you look at like the top 100 list and you watch it and you're like, all right. I guess that was artistic. No, it's like actually good. Like it's a good movie. And there's this guy. It's basically like Shawshank Redemption meets The Great Gatsby. Like that's essentially the film. So there's this guy who gets double-crossed by his old friend, which is a bummer, but it's a great way to start a movie, okay? He gets double-crossed by his old friend. His friend wants his girl, of course, because she's beautiful. And so he gets sent to prison, and he gets this unjust trial. He gets falsely sentenced to, like, a lifetime in prison, and he's in this prison, and he's ticked, okay? Like, he's ticked because his friend double-crossed him and is stealing his girl. Anyway, you know, it's a great movie. Okay, anyway. This guy is in prison, and he eventually figures out a way to escape, and he escapes. He finally escapes. I just covered like an hour of the film, but he escapes, okay? And then he's on this beach, like literally running around. He's just like, yes! Like he's literally enjoying his life. He's like sand between his toes. He's like, I'm free. And then literally all of a sudden, he like looks up, and he's kind of making a fool of himself because he just got his freedom. And he looks up, and there's like just a crew of pirates right there. And he's like, oh, man, like, this is bad luck. Like, this is just a bunch of murderers, you know, and they're probably going to kill me. And so anyway, he, like, showed up to these people, and then he's sitting down with, like, the captain. And the captain's like, wow, this is really interesting. Like, by the look of your clothes, like, I'm pretty sure you escaped from that prison. So here's the deal. We would normally just kill you. Like, that's what we would normally do. But today's a special day because we have this guy, Jacopo. And he, like, points over there, and it's like this kind of just guy who's like buried in the sand, and he's like this bad pirate. Like he's like a bad version of a bad guy. Like he's, you know, he's like the thief of the pirates, right? And so they're like, yeah, here's the thing, Jacopo used to be cool, but he started stealing from us. And so we actually came here to like bury him alive in the sand. So we came here to do, but then you came up, and so here's my idea. Some of my crew kind of wants me to show mercy, but if I show mercy, I seem weak. And so here's what we're gonna do. Here's a knife. And then he gives Jacopo a knife, and he's like, now you guys fight to the death. And whoever kills the other person lives. And whoever dies, dies. And he's like, okay. And he's like, well, I guess this is better than prison, so sure, right? And so they end up going after it, you know? And then as they're, like, going, the guy's like, oh, man, like, here's the thing. Jacopo is, like, the best knife fighter I've ever seen in my life, right? He's amazing. But, like, as you watch the movie, like, he's in prison for, like, 25 years, and it just happens, like, this Mr. Miyagi type guy is like his, you know, his prison roommate, and like teaches him how to like sword fight and do all this really fast, like, you know, like the thing you do with the water, like he does all that, right? And so he's like an amazing sword fighter. He's an amazing sword fighter, and he destroys Jacopo, okay? This like really, he's kind of like this bumbling Mr. Schmee type guy, right, okay? And so anyway, he like destroys him. He's on the ground and he like, you know, the guy who got released from prison, the count, before he's the count, he has this knife on Jacopo's neck. And he's about to kill him so that he can gain his freedom. And at the very last second, he looks at him and he just says, don't say anything. And then he grabs his knife, and he has the two knives, and he kind of looks at the captain and he goes, okay, here's the thing. I know he deserves to die. He's a thief, he's a liar, he's a traitor. He should definitely die. But here's the thing. He just had a horrible day, okay? He was about to get buried alive. He, like, I mean, he's probably pooed himself right now. Like, he's had a horrible day, and he begins to beg for the life of this man. He doesn't know him, but he begins to beg for his life. And he's like, he will be faithful to you. He will be faithful to you. Keep him alive. Don't kill him. He doesn't need to die. He doesn't need to die. And he eventually wins the captain over. The captain goes, okay, sure. One more guy in our crew. And as he's standing up, about to go, because he doesn't even know this guy, Jacopo grabs him. He grabs, like, the scruff of his cloak, and he pulls him in close. And it's like this really emotional moment in the film. And he's like, I mean, he knows that he's supposed to be dead. Like, he deserves to be dead. And he grabs him close, and he's like, I am your man forever. Right? And then the other guy's like, I know. He's like, I know. Like, you owe me, you know? But that's what's interesting. He says, like, I am your man forever. Limitless. And through the rest of the film, the entire rest of the film, Jacopo, he follows around the count, and he's like, I will do anything for you. Because literally every single breath I'm breathing is a grace gift from you. I was supposed to be dead. You saved me. It was grace alone. And when you're saved by grace alone, there are no limits. There is no way you can pay back that person. And in 2 years, he doesn't say, okay, I've been following you around. I've been like your indentured servant for 2 years. Now I've paid you back. That never happens. No, he says, I'm your man forever. Jesus does not give this man a minimum, and he doesn't give us a minimum of how we need to love and who we need to love, because there is no limit to what God can ask of us. When you are saved by grace alone, when you were half dead in a ditch, and Jesus saved you at the cost of his life, he says simply, you go and do likewise. There are no limits. There is no minimum box that you can check to justify yourself. You owe God everything. And Jesus says, not so that you can pay him back, but he just says, you go and do likewise. Now this is the question, how do we actually become like this Good Samaritan? And I just want to get practical for just a sec. Here's kind of how we do this. Here's how we become like this Good Samaritan. The first thing, it's kind of what we've been talking about, is you remember that you were once in a ditch. The beautiful thing about a ditch in a road is that you can't look down on others because you occupy the lowest spot on the road. That's the thing about a ditch, right? You can't look down on anyone because everyone else is above you. And when you remember that you're in a ditch or you were in a ditch, you never have this kind of standing on your own righteousness, looking down on other people. No, you stand in the ditch and you go, I was completely helpless and saved by grace. Who am I to look down on anyone? So remember that you were in a ditch. The second thing is that we need to be people who see the people God puts in our path. When we remember that we were in a ditch, when we see the people God puts in our path, we will identify with them. Now here's the thing, we live in a world, right, where like you go on Facebook and it's like you see endless tragedy and endless need, and it can be completely overwhelming. There's like a psychological disorder where people go online and they literally can't control themselves because of how much need is being presented to them. It's like this trauma disorder because they're just seeing so much need that they can't do anything about. We're bombarded by this stuff, and what I want to say is, the thing that we need to do is we need to see the people that God puts in our path. You don't need to go looking for need everywhere. You just need to look right in front of you because there are needy people everywhere, and we need to start being neighbors to them. You don't need to change your path. You just need to open your eyes as you walk down your path. The third thing is this. We need to love people by actually meeting their needs. And in order to meet people's needs, you have to actually know them. Now, the Samaritan, like, he knew this, right? Like, he goes over to this guy, and he studies his wounds and his scars enough, and he spends enough time with him so that he really knows what kind of bandages he needs, so that he really knows how to do the oil and the wine and how to help this person. We can't help people if we don't know them. We can't meet people's needs if we don't know what their needs actually are. And so we need to meet their needs, but we need to love people by being with people. This is the fourth thing. Don't ask God to give you a minimum requirement. Ask God to give you a vision for a radically generous life. This is the last thing. This is maybe the big take home. Don't ask God to give you the minimum requirement that you need to do, but ask God to give you a vision for a radically generous life. Don't be like the lawyer. Or the lawyer who sought to justify himself by saying, just give me the bare minimum and then I'll hit that. And I will be good in my eyes. No, be like the one who's lying half dead in the ditch. That after he is saved by the Samaritan, he looks at his entire life as a grace gift and all his possessions as a grace gift and feels the freedom to just love and take care of those around him because everything he has been given to him by someone else. We're gonna sing a song tonight, and that's kind of what we're gonna transition into. And it's a song, Just Grace Alone. And the reason we're gonna sing this, we're gonna kind of sing it in a different way than we normally do, a little slower, a little more contemplative. And you can enter in, or you can just listen. But the reason we're singing the song Grace Alone is because this is what we need. The only way that this world is going to be fixed, and the only way that we as Salt Company are going to be able to go out into the world and be neighbors to the people that come along our path is if we see ourselves as people who truly have been saved by nothing else but grace alone. Let me pray for us towards that end. Jesus, we recognize and we confess that we so often in our lives are very self-righteous people. And Jesus, we are like the lawyer where we look around this world and whether we look at people who are in high places of power in our country, or whether we look at people who are picketing around Washington, or whether we look at the person who lives in the dorm room next to us, Jesus, we have a tendency, because we disagree with them, to devalue them and to look down on them because we are self-righteous people. And Jesus, we cannot love people if we're looking down at them. We cannot be neighbors with them if we place ourselves on a pedestal above them. Jesus, would you help us to see ourselves as truly broken and truly in need of saving? God, would we see ourselves as people that were in a ditch, left for dead, that were saved by you? And now would we go into the world and go find other people that are in a ditch, no matter whether that ditch is the ditch of being a liberal or a Republican or a Syrian refugee. God, Jesus, whatever it is, would you help us to find people that need our help? And when we see them, would we have compassion on them? In your name.